It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll find out why the majority of states don't regulate independent tax preparers and discuss some of the tax headaches people say that's created.
But first, unconfirmed reports say the commander of Russia's Black Sea Fleet gave an ultimatum to Ukrainian forces earlier today to clear out of the Crimean Peninsula or face a military storm. But Russia's foreign ministry gave a conflicting statement that says the Black Sea Fleet isn't involved.
Tensions have escalated in Ukraine as Russia sent military troops to its bases in Crimea, an autonomous region of eastern Ukraine that is strongly pro-Russian, many of its citizens are. Protests have been ongoing in Ukraine since November, when the Ukrainian president turned down a deal with the European Union, went for closer ties with Russia instead.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is scheduled to visit Kiev in Ukraine to address the rising tensions there. Jeremy Suri joins us now. He's the Mac Brown Distinguished Chair of Leadership in Global Affairs, History, and Public Policy at the University of Texas, Austin. His latest book is Liberty's Surest Guardians. Jeremy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
So today, the interim prime minister of Ukraine, Yatsenyuk, has said that he feels the peak of the crisis between Ukraine and Russia has passed. And on the other hand, there were these unconfirmed reports that we've had about a Russian ultimatum to Ukraine, the message being surrender now or face attack. So do you have a sense which is it? Are tensions being diffused or are they ramping up?
I think tensions are clearly ramping up. And I think they're ramping up because of actions on both sides. We have a classic case of escalating threats and escalating activities that are only making the situation on the ground more difficult to resolve. You have a Russian leadership under Vladimir Putin, which has set out the period before the attack on Georgia, which occurred in 2008, to really assert itself in the region as the regional dominant home for all Russian peoples. And that's the argument they're making now. But you also have a Ukrainian leadership coming out of the recent protest movement that's seeking to assert itself, to show its legitimate leadership group for Ukraine, and to call in Western support, particularly American support. So you see both sides exaggerating and escalating the situation, and that's a very dangerous phenomenon.
Well, Russia has been saying that its presence in Crimea is intended to protect the Russians living there. Some 60% of Crimea's population is Russian. So do you have a sense how the Russians in Crimea are reacting so far?
Well, from everything I've read, the Russians in Crimea, and they're about 58% of the population there, they feel a closer affinity to Russia than they do to the government in Kiev, Ukraine. And there are all kinds of reasons why that might be true. But there's no evidence that they were calling for Russian troops to enter. No, there was no vote on this. There was no consensus or referendum on it. And I think it boggles the mind to try to believe that Vladimir Putin really has their interests in mind. If he did, he wouldn't have sent his troops into attack. He would have tried to pursue other measures that would make sure their interests were recognized in the election that's going to be coming up in Ukraine and in other activities in the region. It doesn't appear to me that this was an effort to protect the Russian people in the Ukraine at all.
Well, some analysts are saying that Vladimir Putin's ultimate goal looks a lot like Russian imperialism or a Eurasian Union. If Russia takes Crimea, will it stop there?
I'm afraid it won't. I mean, my concern, and I think the concern shared by many analysts, is that the argument the Russians are making is an argument that would justify Russian aggression not simply in Ukraine and not simply in Crimea, but in other parts of the eastern and northeastern parts of Europe that contain other large Russian populations, the Baltic populations in Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, parts of other countries surrounding Ukraine. This was the argument that Vladimir Putin made in 2008 for attacking Georgia. So this is a very dangerous argument. When you argue that you, as a large country, have a right to intervene in neighboring countries because they have large numbers of people who share a linguistic or ethnic connection to your country, that justifies not just imperialism, it justifies warfare. And that's a real worry I think we have to have right now.
Well, and there's speculation right now that what Putin is trying to do is to turn back the clock and take back some of the splintering that happened when the USSR dissolved. Do you see truth in that?
I think that's true. I think he's been quite explicit about that. He's called the breakup of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War one of the worst tragedies in Russian history. And he has really made it a clear program, including his efforts through the Olympics, to make Russia appear strong again, strong at home and strong abroad. And this is a rational strategy from his point of view. Russia is in many ways a second-rate economy in the world today. They are facing major demographic decline. Their energy resources are worth less than they were before. So they need to do something to assert themselves as a great power. And one way to do that, it's an old strategy, is to assert a regional role as the dominant power in Central Asia and Eastern Europe. And I think that's what Vladimir Putin is doing. I think he's been quite explicit about it.
Now, there's a split in the country between Western Ukraine, which seems to have sort of an affiliation with the European Union, and Eastern Ukraine, which has very close ties to Russia. What is the chance of a reconciliation between these two sides right now?
I think we have to be careful, Veronica, not to overstate these divisions. There is definitely a historical difference between Eastern and Western Ukraine. There are ethnic and linguistic differences as well. But many countries have those kinds of divisions, and they overcome them. And in many ways, it looked like Ukraine was doing reasonably well in the last few years dealing with those divisions. I think there are people, large numbers of the population in the eastern part of Ukraine, who do feel closer to Russia, but that does not mean that they want unification with Russia. There are also many of them very skeptical about Vladimir Putin, very skeptical about Russian leadership, just as there are those in the western part of Ukraine who might not be super enthusiastic about joining the European Union. What tends to happen in these circumstances in all sorts of countries is that the most extreme voices, which are non-representative of the population at large, are the ones that tend to be most dominant.
So framing this as an ethnic conflict is false. Do you agree? I think that we have lost Jeremy Suri. We'll try to get him back on the line, and we will just check on that, see if we can grab him again. Jeremy, are you with us?
Yep. Can you hear me?
Yes. Now I can hear you again. Yeah, you just dropped out for a moment. Did you hear my last question?
I did indeed. There are ethnic elements to the conflict, but it is not a purely ethnic conflict. It is a conflict over resources that ethnicity is one component of.
And what stance do you think Ukrainians are hoping for from the West and the rest of the world in terms of support?
Well, I think many Ukrainians want stability. Many Ukrainians want the promise of a less corrupt government than the government they had before. And many of them want the ability to do business with their European neighbors. But that doesn't mean that they want to do everything that we would want them to do. And that doesn't mean that they want to forsake their connection to Russia. I think they want a stable, productive, non-corrupt economy. And those are things they don't have right now.
President Obama has spoken out in favor of Ukrainian sovereignty. What tools does he have at his disposal now?
Well, our tools are limited because we are far away and we don't want to get into a war and we cannot change the situation on the ground immediately. But we have a lot of influence in terms of flows of trade, both into Ukraine but also to Russia. And we also are an important player in Russia's larger relationship with the wider world. Putin wants to be a respected international leader. So I think we have the ability to make it clear that there will be a heavy economic penalty for Russia to pay. And certainly in the long run, that is something Russia does not want to do. They need to trade with us. About a quarter of their trade goes just directly into Europe, not to mention into the wider Western world. So we have a great deal of influence upon the future of the Russian economy.
We're talking right now to international affairs expert Jeremy Suri about the escalating tensions between Ukraine and Russia. We're continuing our discussion about the latest news in Crimea now with international relations expert Jeremy Suri. We're talking about the role the United States might play in resolving the conflict in Ukraine.
And we're taking your calls now. What do you think the U.S. should do about this situation, if anything? Economic sanctions? Stand back? Try to facilitate negotiations? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
And let's go right to our callers. We have Steve joining us from Fish Creek. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. How about you?
I'm great. Thanks. Hey, wonderful show, and I wish you the best for your fundraising.
Thank you.
You have the best station out of all of radio. So,
wow.
All the best to you. My quick question to you was just, does your guest know anything? We haven't heard anything, or if we have, I've missed it. How have the Chinese responded to this? Have they jumped on board? Have they refused to comment? Are they for or against? What are your thoughts?
Okay, thanks a lot, Steve. And Jeremy, what about China in this?
It's a great question that Steve raises. The Chinese generally are very upset anytime any country intervenes anywhere to violate the national sovereignty of that country. They are very concerned about Russia, the United States, or other countries violating their sovereignty. So the Chinese have been fairly critical of this. Now, they are not getting out front on this issue, but actually down the line, look for the United States and China to be on the same page. The Chinese do not want to see Russia moving into neighboring territories and claiming it has a right to move into those territories. Remember that Russia and China share a very long disputed border.
Now, Jeremy, you've mentioned that China and the United States at this point on the same page. Does that mean the translation to action for China will be there as well?
Well, the Chinese generally don't want to get involved in any kind of peacekeeping force or any kind of activity that will involve military affairs outside of Asia. So I don't think we'll see them militarily involved. But I do think we could see them supporting a United Nations Security Council resolution that condemns Russia. And I do think we could also see them involved with the diplomacy to try to convince Putin to leave Crimea or at least to stop his continued violent activities there.
All right. Well, thanks for that call and the kind words as well. And let's go next to Steve in Eau Claire. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how are you doing?
Okay. How are you?
Okay, first of all, pretty hard to have a Security Council resolution to condemn Russia when Russia's part of the Security Council. But that's neither here nor there. You know, it gets pretty wild when I actually am not going to support Putin, but I can see some perspective that they may have. This fellow Yanukovych, who was president, who has been ousted, he got elected in 2010 in an election that was monitored. And why couldn't the protesters just wait until the next election, which is a few months down the road, and get rid of him through democratic means? After all, when the Orange Revolution protesters took over in 2005, I believe, they were reelected 2-3 times, and they kept messing up and not doing a very good job in the economy. And now when this guy wins, they don't like it. It's Wisconsin. People try to kick out Scott Walker after they protested in Wisconsin in the state halls in Madison. Didn't like it. And so then they get rid of the guy.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot for that. And the question, Jeremy, why didn't Ukrainians wait to oust Yanukovych at the election?
Well, the problem is that Ukrainians, many of them, were convinced that Yanukovych was so corrupt that he wasn't going to allow a fair election and that he was intentionally violating what were the basic legal and institutional means for governing that society. It's not just whether someone's elected, it's whether they follow the law. And I think there was pretty clear agreement that Yanukovych was not following the law. Now, whether he would have allowed for elections, we don't know. But the protests were aimed at dealing with the corruption and dealing with the illegality of his behavior. There was a very clear mandate for Ukraine to cooperate with the European Union, and he instead, Yanukovych, accepted $15 billion from Russia to explicitly violate public opinion on this. So he had broken the law as a leader. That doesn't justify necessarily overthrowing him, but it explains the protests. And then the protests produced so much anger against him that he was forced to flee. So I don't think you can defend Yanukovych in this. Putin's not even defending Yanukovych. The question is, what do you do next? And I would argue that invading and tearing apart the country, as Russia has, is not the right reaction to this true crisis.
How much stability and power does the current interim government in Ukraine have right now?
Well, it's hard to say, and I certainly don't know for certain. I will say that the Russian attack on Crimea has rallied many people in the western parts of Ukraine to this new interim government, and it has provided it with some reason for existence. But it doesn't have strong consensus behind it. It doesn't necessarily have international legitimacy. And I'm not sure to what extent the Ukrainian military, which is in some sense now under attack by the Russian military in Ukraine, actually in Crimea, I'm not sure the extent to which the military will follow the government's orders. So we don't know the answer to that question.
And stepping back now to get a bigger picture, this weekend, the former prime minister of Ukraine, Yulia Tymoshenko, said that by occupying Crimea, Russia's essentially declaring war on the U.S. and the United Kingdom. What is your response to that?
Oh, well, no, they're not declaring war on the United States and the United Kingdom. They're declaring war on Ukraine. Crimea is an acknowledged, although autonomous, part of what was the Ukrainian state, as recognized internationally, as recognized by Russia itself under treaties following the end of the Soviet Union. So this was an act of war against Ukraine, just as if we attacked northern Mexico, that would be an act of war against Mexico. But this was not an attack on the United States or Great Britain, and Ukraine is not a member of NATO, so we do not have a security guarantee that requires us to come to Ukraine's military defense in the way we would have to come to the military defense of Germany, for example.
So you're saying that Russia has its sights set squarely on Crimea, perhaps Ukraine in general, and that there are no undertones here of, you know, maybe even thumbing the nose at the West?
Well, no, I think Putin is definitely thumbing his nose at the U.S., but that's different from an act of war.
Mm-hmm.
Countries thumb their nose at each other all the time, and international relations is a dirty junkyard game of rivalry and coercion and bullying. So Putin is playing that game in a hard-nosed and very strategic way, and his vision and his goals, I think, are to be the dominant player, to be in some sense the bully of his part of the world. I don't think he has a global mission. I think he has a regional mission, and he's very happy to call out American hypocrisy and to make Obama look weak in the process because that serves his purposes.
Now, Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague called the Ukrainian conflict, quote, the biggest crisis in Europe of the 21st century. What is the worst case scenario here?
Well, I fear, Veronica, that Ukraine could become another Yugoslavia. And many of us came of age watching Yugoslavia disintegrate and hundreds of thousands of people dying as a consequence, right, in the heart of Europe. And as in Ukraine today, you had mixed ethnic populations. You had an east and a west, north and south sets of divisions. You had Muslim populations. We haven't talked about that yet, but there is about 10 to 12% of the population in Crimea. There's Muslim Tatars who have suffered extraordinary mistreatment under the Soviet Union and to some extent under Russia. And we could see a long civil war, which will create lots and lots of deaths and lots of suffering on a scale similar to Yugoslavia or Syria. Once again, and that's a terrible tragedy, not to mention a big geopolitical risk to many countries.
Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for coming on and helping us understand it today.
Thank you for having me on, and thanks for asking such great questions.
We were talking with Jeremy Suri, Professor of Global Affairs, History, and Public Policy at the University of Austin, Texas. His latest book is Liberty's Surest Guardian. He was with us to talk about the escalating tensions between Ukraine and Russia in the Crimea Peninsula.
We're just over a month away from tax day, and all across the country, accountants and independent tax preparers are crunching numbers and filling out form after form. No surprise there, but what separates those two groups is the amount of regulation each is subject to.
While accountants are subject to rules and regulations, our next guest points out that only four states require testing and continuing education for the hundreds of thousands of independent tax preparers who make a living deciphering the U.S. tax code. And for the other 46 states, some have called it the Wild West of tax prep.
Joining us now is Elaine Povich. She's a staff writer at Stateline, the daily news service of the Pew Charitable Trusts, where she covers tax and budget issues. She recently wrote about the lack of regulation for independent tax preparers. Elaine, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, happy to be here.
Let's start by defining who these people are. If I'm going to get my taxes done, I may not even be aware what the difference is between an independent tax preparer and an accountant.
Sure. First off, if you go to an accountant, a CPA, they're regulated. You go to an attorney, they're regulated too. And there's something called enrolled agents, which are agents, tax preparers who are certified by the IRS. That's all fine. But in many states, in most states, as you just said, you don't have to be any of those three things to prepare taxes. You can simply put out a shingle outside your house and say, taxes done here. Have people come, fill out their forms, collect money, and nobody knows boo about whether you know what the heck you're doing or you don't know what the heck you're doing.
So the four states that do regulate, that don't include Wisconsin, first of all, what do they do there?
First of all, the four are California, Oregon, Maryland, and New York. And essentially what all of them do with little tweaks here and there is that they require someone who wants to be a tax preparer to take a course. About 60 hours worth of coursework. One, California requires a $5,000 bond, and you have to take a test. And all four of those states require that you take that test periodically. You don't just get certified once because, as we all know, tax laws change, and you have to keep up with it. So in the four states, you've got to take a test periodically to certify that you are a tax preparer.
So why no regulations in the bulk of the union?
A lot of it has to do with sort of the way tax preparation kind of grew up topsy-turvy. Taxes used to be, I don't know, maybe 50, 60 years ago. I'm not old enough to remember, but a lot of people are. Yeah, they were pretty simple. You had a few deductions here, a few deductions there. And, you know, Hank down the street, he was pretty good at math, so he started doing taxes. And states have not seen fit to regulate them. Now, the IRS decided that this was a really bad idea. So they promulgated a bunch of rules requiring all tax preparers to do the same, essentially the same thing as their enrolled agents do, take a course, take a test, pay a fee. Well, a bunch of independent tax preparers went to court and said, you can't do this. And it turned out the court said, you're right. The IRS is not empowered to write these kinds of regulations. Only the Congress can do that. And the Congress, as we all know, is not exactly lickety-split here with the new laws and regulations. So it's just not there.
Is there any evidence of damage, though, that that needs to be addressed?
Sure. Every year, tax preparers get caught doing things that are unscrupulous, illegal, or otherwise bad for taxpayers. Kevin Durant, the basketball player for the NBA, actually sued his tax preparer recently for $300,000 because the guy who did his taxes messed up and took a bunch of deductions, which you gotta love. He tried to deduct his personal chef as a business expense, but okay. Anyway, the IRS decided, no, that's not right, and they decided that they were gonna fine Kevin Durant, and Kevin Durant said, wait a minute, I didn't do these taxes, my guy did. Now, it's not always the independents that are the bad apples, but there are some. And if you go to someone to do your taxes, you need to be very careful that you know that the person that you're going to is somebody who knows the laws and is following the rules. And if it were me, I would go to somebody who has been certified as an enrolled agent or someone who's otherwise been regulated.
Are there movements in states, assuming Congress doesn't jump on this for a while, are there states where people are trying to get the kind of regulations on independent tax preparers that four states have?
Yeah, a few. I don't believe in yours, but in Ohio, there's a consumer group that's trying to write similar regulations for Ohio taxpayers. And there are a few around the country, but it doesn't seem to have been a groundswell exactly.
I'm guessing probably out there listening now are some very legitimate independent tax preparers who would say, hey, I've been doing this year after year. I stay on top of things. I do a good job. Why do I need to pay for a class, jump through more hoops?
Well, that's exactly the reason that the independent tax preparers sued in court to avoid the regulations. And I would say to them, hey, if you've been doing taxes for years and you're good at it and you're keeping up with all the regulations, it's not that big a deal. And in fact, it might bring you more business because people would look at your wooden shingle that you're hanging outside your door and you can say, certified tax preparer by the state of Wisconsin. You might get more business that way. And if you really are keeping up and you're doing a good job, and I don't think it should be that big a deal, most states, actually all states, and the District of Columbia, license and regulate barbers and hairdressers and stylists. And nobody objects to the fact that every time you go to a hairstylist, there's a little license sitting up there in the corner of the mirror that says, yep, I can do this. I would think the tax preparers would think the same thing.
I know you're not a tax preparer yourself, but what's the takeaway here for people who haven't, like me, who haven't gotten their taxes together yet this year?
And me. if you hire someone to do it, make sure that they are certified by someone, either the IRS is an enrolled agent or they are a CPA or they're an attorney. Unless you know them very, very well and you expect that they are good at what they do. But if you don't know who your tax preparer is, then go for the certification. You can't go wrong.
Elaine, thanks so much for spending this time with us today.
Happy to be here.
That's Elaine Povich. She's a staff writer at Stateline, the daily news service of the Pew Charitable Trust, where she covers tax and budget issues. She recently wrote about the lack of regulation in most states, including Wisconsin, for independent tax preparers.